Hi, my name is Debbie Friday, and I am Canadian. I grew up in Montreal, and I live in Toronto now, and I'm here in Stockholm at Frederick's apartment, and we're going to talk about music.
You're so welcome, Debbie.
Thank you for having me.
You just won the prestigious Polaris Award.
Yes.
Which is Canada's equivalent to the British Mercury Award, in a way.
Yeah.
But I was first a bit confused because I didn't know of it, but we have something here in Sweden called the Polar Music Prize, which they give out every year to some mostly like pretty old artists who have a long career behind them. I think the most famous Canadian to have received the Polar Music Prize is Joni Mitchell.
Oh, okay.
And also Bob Dylan and people like that. So when I talked about your album on TV the other day, and I said she just got the Polaris Award, and everyone was like, she got the Polar Music Prize. That's interesting. but that was for your debut album, Good Luck.
Yes, yeah.
And what was that like to receive that prize? Did things start, you know, happening in a major way after it, or was it big?
Yeah, I think like this whole year has been just like this really big shift in my career, just because it's like my first album, like a proper album that I've put out. Like before, I had put out EPs, you know, which are shorter projects and have like a different kind of rollouts and everything. But this was like my first time really making like something that was a cohesive project, and that was also long form in this kind of way. And so everything has been so different this year in my career. And then winning the Polaris on top of it, it was just really, honestly, like unexpected. And just, it's been so crazy since it's happened. Like, I went back on tour and I have all these like plans. I put out a new single, and like, I'm even working on my next album, and I can feel the difference in like the before and after of both winning the prize and also putting out the album and stuff. And, you know, now I have less student loans as well because I got to pay some of it off.
Yeah, you got $50,000 to pay off your student loans. Did you study a lot?
I did,
What kind of stuff?
So I did a bachelor's degree in political science and women's studies. And then I went back to school and I did a master's of fine arts in interdisciplinary studies.
When I first listened to you, I think that was the Bitch Punk EP.
Yeah.
I was struck by how close some of your stuff was to the style of music that you sometimes call industrial music, like Nine Inch Nails and things like that. What kind of sound do you strive for?
I think when I was making Bitch Punk, really that the inspiration for that sonically came from a lot of music that I would listen to growing up. Like I always was attracted to like more intense, hard sounds. And I really liked a lot of like dissonant music. And then, so before I started making music, I was a DJ. And when I was DJing, like at the time, there was this thing called like Deconstructed Club that was very popular. And so I was really into a lot of like electropunk, Deconstructed Club. I was really influenced by people like Death Grips and Nine Inch Nails and stuff like that. So I was drawn to those kind of sounds, and you can hear the influences all over. But then I also had, it also has this kind of high energy to it that it kind of comes from, you know, hyper pop and like the things that were happening online at the time. I'd say it's really mediated by the internet, because that's how I got to hear all this music.
Yeah, because you grew up during the downloading era.
Yeah.
I would assume that, you know, file sharing networks like LimeWire and SoulSeek maybe meant a lot to you.
Yeah, I don't know SoulSeek, but I definitely remember LimeWire, yeah.
That was my favorite too. Yeah. I still remember when the first track I downloaded from LimeWire was this, what they called like a bastard pop remix with Eminem rapping over an old Smith song.
Really? Yeah. Wow, cool.
I love the logo, like a slice of lime.
Yeah, the green and yellow.
So you got to experience lots of music that you wouldn't have heard otherwise, perhaps.
Yeah, totally. Like, and experience it in this kind of way where you didn't there was no like entry fee to the music. Because I think, at least my understanding is that previously, in order to be like introduced to a scene, you kind of have to be initiated through either going to shows or you know somebody who like introduces you to stuff. And then there's this whole initiation process with it. But with the internet, you can just download it and then you have access to that space. And I've heard like people kind of talk about both like the pros and cons of it, but I just think it's like a net positive just overall, because I think sharing music is the point of music.
That we loved. Beyond all the others. All the wires. It was the wires that were the wires for empathy that we love beyond all the others.
So this is Fear of the Unknown and the Blazing Sun by Colin Stetson.
Streaming in ghosts made of smoke and paper trees.
Who's Colin Stetson?
So Colin Stetson, he's a Canadian, actually. He's a Canadian artist and incredibly talented musician. And he's done a lot of soundtracks and a lot of music for like shows and TV and movies. And that's how I was introduced to his work. And I really just was so taken, in particular by this album, just because it's like, it was the first time I heard somebody use like saxophone in this kind of way. Like, it's really beautiful, like instrumentation, and just it almost puts me in like this meditative state, like when I'm listening to the music, because it's so trance inducing and the way that he uses the instrument is like really unique, very beautiful.
Father into his father.
And this is Laurie Anderson speaking, right?
Yeah. Like throughout the album, there's different interludes with, I guess you could call it like spoken word. And it's like spoken word poetry and stuff. And it's very, very beautiful.
Is this mesmerizing?
Yeah. It's great. I love this track.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
You're a millennial, but you've described yourself as a zillennial. What on earth is that, a zillennial?
I've been described as I think it's like somebody called me that once, and then I guess everyone just decided to go with it. But it's like, I guess like being in between generations, like I'm considered at the tail end of the millennial generation, and then very at the very beginning of Gen Z. So yeah, I feel like very like in between, because also I am the oldest of four. So I'm like the oldest sibling, and I had all younger siblings. And so, you know, growing up with them and stuff, you kind of have this like mixing of the generations happening. But I wouldn't call me, like, I don't think I'm Gen Z, but I would say Zillennial. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
And you were born in Nigeria.
Yeah.
And came to Canada when you were 2 years old.
Yeah.
What made your family move?
I think it was about like economic opportunity, because especially at that time, there just wasn't the opportunity at all. And like both my parents, you know, they come from humble origins. Like nobody in their family had left before. So they were really like the first people in their families to like leave Nigeria. And it was my dad who left first, and he came to Canada and settled in Montreal, and then he went back to Nigeria and he met my mom, and then they got married, they had me, and then eventually like he brought us over to Canada. And yeah, I think it was like really like because of economic reasons, but I think also just, you know, my dad had an adventurous spirit. Like he had he left home when he was 19 himself. He left Nigeria when he was 19 and kind of like traveled the world and wanted to see the world and see something different. And I always thought that that was really brave of him. And I think that's something I've inherited from him.
What did he do during his adventures?
Honestly, really just kind of anything. Like he went around, he was in Europe for a bit. He was in Germany, I think was the first place that he went to. And then he went around and he was in China, and then he was going to go to the US, but, I forget why, but there was some reason why he couldn't end up in the US. And so instead he ended up in Canada, and then that's how our family stayed in Canada.
What did they work with when you were a child?
So my mom's a nurse, and then my dad, he used to do computer science, but he's a realtor now.
Did your family have a lot of rules when you grew up?
Yes. Yeah. Very strict, very like conservative, because Nigerian culture is just like a lot more conservative than Canadian culture, and very religious as well too. So it was like very, very strict upbringing.
Some of my friends who have parents who are from like immigrant parents, their parents tend to have very specific ideas about what their kids should do. You know, it's either become a doctor or a lawyer.
Yeah.
And other professions don't really exist.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of pressure.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Like when I was growing up, that was it. It was like, you can either be a doctor, a lawyer, or an engineer. And I think my family wanted me to be a lawyer because I was really good at arguing all the time. And so they were like, oh yeah, you're going to be a lawyer. But I never really, even in school, like I was good at school in some aspects, but I didn't have like, I didn't really have an interest to do like any traditional job. Like I thought, okay, like maybe I'll do some, like, that's why I did political science. Like my first degree, I was like, okay, maybe I'll do this and then eventually go into law or something. But I didn't have the passion for it. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I just was kind of trying to figure myself out. And it's only when I started doing music, that was when I really started feeling like, oh, this is what I'm passionate about.
You became a club kid in your teens. You went to clubs a lot.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
What was the attraction there? What did you, you know, experience when he went out?
I loved to party. I loved to party. I loved going out. I loved the whole ritual of it because, you know, you get together with your friends and you get ready and, you know, you're having a good time. You put on music to get ready to go to this place. And then you go there and everybody gets dressed up and you're there to like have a really good time. And you spend like hours in this place and you're listening to really good music and just vibing out. And it really feels like you're part of this collective experience. And so I think that really drew me in as far as like the party scene. And also I always loved music. I loved music. I love good music. I love dancing. Like I love the release that comes with going out and like with club culture. You get a really good like emotional release.
So how did you sneak out from your strict family?
Oh, I would lie. I would say, oh, I'm going to go sleep over at my friend's house. And then we would go out and we had like fake IDs. And so that's how we would get into clubs at first. But then I moved out actually when I was 18 years old. So I moved out of home when I was 18. And then after I went wild. I just did whatever I wanted.
And how did you start DJing?
So I started DJing after I finished my first degree. I was in Montreal, and a friend just, like, this girl that I knew just through going out, she, like, asked me, like, hey, do you want to DJ this party I'm hosting? I think it was, like, a fundraiser or something. And I think I had expressed interest in wanting to DJ because I knew other women who were DJing at the time, and I thought it was really cool, and I loved to go out, but I had never done it before. And so she was like, do you want to DJ this party? And I said, yeah, sure. And so then I taught, like, someone taught me how to use is this program called Virtual DJ, and I had, like, this little controller that I bought. It was like $100, just a piece of crap, but I used that and I DJed that party, and it went really, really good. And so that's how I started.
It seems as if you were really ambitious.
Yeah.
So the partying never, like, prevented you from, you know, doing the things that you wanted to do?
No, like, I think that when I look back on it, it's like, I've always been this person who has, like, drive. Like, that's something I know about myself, is like, I have this really intense drive, but before I didn't have a place to focus it. So it was kind of unfocused, and it would go instead into things like, okay, like, my focus is going to be, I'm just going to go and party and, like, go crazy and stuff. But then once I kind of started building once I saw that, oh, I can make a career for myself and I could do this as a career, is when it kind of clicked in my mind of this is a way that I can focus all the energy I have. Like, I'm really intense as a person. And so you need a place to direct that when you're an intense person.
How did your parents react when you told them that you were becoming a DJ instead of a lawyer?
Oh, they didn't like it. Yeah, they didn't like it at all at first. Like, I think they thought that I was, like, just, you know, I was out of control. They, like, especially my mom, I think she was just really worried, and, like, because they don't have an understanding of, you know, arts as a career is not something that they really have a reference for, because nobody in my family had done this. You know, we're immigrants as well. Like, there's no, for them, there was just, like, they didn't understand that, oh, this is something that people do. And so they're really worried, and they really didn't like it at first. But I think, like, over the years, as I, you know, have started to build my career more and more, they've seen how, like, oh, this is a real thing and she can support herself and take care of herself. So now they're very supportive. Yeah.
What about your siblings? They haven't been, like, inspired to go the same way or anything, or no?
No, none of them. As far as music, no. Like, my brother, he does tech. And one of my sisters, she's kind of, like, in fashion a little bit. And then the other sister, she's too young. She just started university. So she's, like, doing nursing. But I feel like none of them are really in the same industry, but we all have the same thing of, like, drive, where it's like we can be really, really focused. So whatever it is that we want to do, like, we can just, like, zero in, and we're really able to accomplish that.
I just had this other Canadian artist here on the podcast called Danko Jones, who talked about how his parents, who were immigrants from India, never, you know, they still don't accept his job.
Really?
Okay. And he's, you know, in his mid-40s, and he has toured the world, and he's been playing for, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and they still want him to get a regular job.
Wow. Wow. Oh, that makes me a little bit sad. Yeah.
Speaking of Danko Jones, he changed his name to Danko Jones, and Debbie Friday is your artist name.
Yeah.
How did you come up with Debbie Friday?
Well, my real name is Debbie. Like, my family has always called me Debbie. It's short for Deborah. And so I just went with my first name. And for the Friday part, I don't know. It's hard to explain. It's like a little bit of a mystery, I'll say that. Like, it came to me one day.
Well, Friday represents happiness to me. You know,
that's, oh, really?
That's when, well, you know, when Friday is here, you're always in a good mood on Friday.
That's true.
You know, the entire weekend before you.
That's true.
You know, even on a Saturday night, you know that, you know, tomorrow will be Sunday and you'll be slightly depressed because the weekend is almost over.
Oh.
But when it's Friday, you know, it's like the moment before you open your Christmas presents.
Okay. Yeah. I could see that, yeah.
What was the first big concert that you went to?
first big concert I went to. I think it was, I saw The Weeknd in Montreal, because at the it was when he, before he like really blew up and became this huge artist, I believe he played at the Metropolis. And I went with a friend of mine who was a big fan of his, and I had heard his mixtapes. I really liked his music. And we went to the Metropolis, and I remember I made a mistake because it was my first concert. So I wore heels to the concert, and I was standing for like 7 hours. Oh my God, my feet hurt so bad. But it was a good show.
How did you then go from DJing to producing and writing music?
So that happened in like between 2017 to 2018. So when I was DJing, I really didn't have a healthy lifestyle. Like I was really, it wasn't healthy. It wasn't like good. I had a lot of issues with like substance use and substance abuse and, you know, just party life.
What kind of stuff? Like really heavy stuff?
Yeah, really heavy stuff. Like, and you know, party.
Not just like weed or anything.
No, like drugs. Yeah, heavy drugs. And like, I had always had like issues with substance abuse because I grew up like very like tough, and I think it was a way of trying to self-soothe and, you know, to deal with pain. But it kind of came to this point where I couldn't do it anymore. Like I just couldn't do anything anymore. I couldn't do the nightlife because nightlife can be really, really heavy, very taxing. Like, and yeah, I just had this moment where I basically was like, I can't do this anymore. So I quit DJing and my life kind of started falling apart. Like everything just fell to pieces. And then I actually left Montreal. This is when I left Montreal and I moved across the country and I had quit DJing, quit everything. But I still love music, of course. And so I was like, you know what? I want to learn how to make music. So I taught myself by watching YouTube tutorials, and I played around first in GarageBand, and then I started using Logic, and I made Bitch Punk, and that was it.
But what kind of things did you experience that made you want to like self-medicate with drugs?
Like in my life?
Yes. Early on, did you have like scars that you tried to
pretty much like a lot of stuff, just like very emotionally heavy stuff. Like I don't necessarily like to talk about it in detail because I think it's like a lot of it requires like this nuance that is hard to get across just like, you know, in a quick interview. I always say like, don't worry, I'm going to write a book. So you can, people will know.
It's just difficult to imagine when you're from a very squeaky clean, nice background.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's not a broken home or anything.
Yeah, I think on the surface, yeah. But I guess like, you know, everybody has problems. Yeah.
So did you have to change friends too when you...
When I left?
When you like quit the...
Oh yeah, I did. I left everything behind. Like friends, like so many... Like I grew up in Montreal, so it was like all that I had known. And leaving that was one of the hardest things I ever had to do. I left everything behind. Like I didn't even take any, like I had my apartment and all this stuff. I didn't take anything. Like I just packed two suitcases with some clothes and some shoes and some books. And I left and that was it. Like it really was like this very hard break in my life. And so I remember feeling like at first, when I first left, I remember just like really deep grief. Like there was a lot of grief that came up and, you know, it's hard. It's a hard thing to do. But then as the months went on and stuff, it's like I started to kind of see a different picture and started to see and understand as well too, like, oh, this is why that had to happen.
And you moved to...
Vancouver.
Yeah. And that's like moving all across Europe because Canada is so huge. It's such a big, it's like the second biggest country in the world, right? After China.
It's huge. It's
huge. Yeah. So, you know, moving there is very definite in a way.
Oh yeah, for sure. It's so different. Like Vancouver's so different from Montreal. And I felt very strange there. Like I felt like I was like an alien in a strange land. But I went back, like I said, I went back to school. Like that's where I did my master's, was in Vancouver. And it was an interesting experience. Like, I can't say that I necessarily like Vancouver, but I did meet a lot of people there who became very important to me. And I learned so much when I was in Vancouver, just about like who I am as a person, but also as an artist and like the things I want to do, because I got to experiment in school. Like, I got to make a lot of different projects. I got to, and also make those projects with like a certain amount of privacy and, you know, so you could try stuff, you can fail, and it doesn't necessarily matter in the same way. So that was really important for me. This is I Wanna Be Where the Boys Are by The Runaways.
Mama's always telling me stay inside. Is that what your mother told you?
Oh yeah, for yeah. sure. For sure.
But you wanted to be where the boys were.
Yeah, I did. I really did. And that's why that's honestly one of my favorite songs from The Runaways. Like, I love so many of their albums and so many of their tracks, but that one in particular, because I identified with it a lot. Like, I always felt growing up, like, boys had so much more freedom than women did. And like, they had freedom both in, like, you know, being able to do whatever they want, but also this kind of like physical freedom, because they could jump around, they could scream, they could yell, they could do all this stuff, and nobody's gonna say anything to them. And I think that's when I think of like, oh, how when I started making music, like my first project, there's a lot of screaming, there's a lot of that going on, and it's because I had this desire to get it out.
You mentioned somewhere that you identified as queer, so you weren't just attracted to where the boys were, but also where the girls were, I suppose.
Sure, yeah. Okay, so. Yeah.
Was that another thing that made you, like, seek out the nightlife? Because there's a freedom there for people who, might be bi or gay.
Well, that's the thing with nightlife, too. It's like it involves so many outliers of society, you know, people who don't fit in, people who are a little bit different, a little bit strange, are always drawn into a nightlife. And you meet so many, like some of the most interesting people, right? And people who are just very different from each other. And so I think that was the same for me. It was like one of the appeals of it. It's like, okay, if I feel like I'm different from other people, like I can go to this place and I can feel like I belong, for sure. Yeah.
Sometimes when you go out and you meet people that are super interesting, you kind of wish that you would be able to talk to them, but the music is so loud.
I know.
We would have such interesting conversations, yeah, if we could speak to each other, but that won't happen.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I want to know more about you, but maybe after.
I read somewhere that you really liked Avril Lavigne as a kid.
Yeah.
It's interesting because lots of guests here have mentioned her. Mm-hmm. And she's not an artist who, you know, maybe people thought would mean a lot back when she, you know, broke through. But but it seems as if she meant a lot to a lot of girls of a certain age.
Yeah, because I think she came out at this time where she was like something different for women and for young girls especially, like, because at the time, like, I also love, you know, like Britney Spears and like pop music like that, and I have a lot of respect for those types of pop stars, but at the time, like growing up, you know, if that is the hegemony, if that's like the mainstream thing, when somebody does something different, it's like so appealing, especially to people who feel like different or outcasted, whatever. And Avril Lavigne came and she was like very like, I'm punk, I'm this, I don't know, like she had this like rock influence and she looked different as well too. She presented herself really differently. And I think a lot of young girls just like really identified with that.
Still love Complicated.
That's an amazing song. It's so good. Yeah. It's so good.
And then Skater Boy.
Yeah.
Which was going to be a movie, I think. Someone bought the rights to turn that song into a movie.
Oh, okay.
How does it start? She was
I don't remember the lyrics, but the tune, yeah.
On some of your tracks, it's as if you're singing to your younger self.
Yeah.
Like on Good Luck, the title track on your album. You better tell the truth now, girl. You better build yourself up. Buttercup? That's a lovely word, buttercup. It's like something that your grandmother would say to you.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, yeah. Speaking affectionately to my younger self.
So is that how you feel about your younger self, like affection? Not,
I do.
Because some people like hate themselves, their previous versions, you know, when they grow older. You know,
No. I can't hate my previous self because it was my previous self that even got me here, you know? I have a lot of respect for my previous self. I think like in a lot of ways, like my younger self, she's tougher than I am now. Because now I feel like I've become like softer a little bit. Like I've been able to become softer and like more gentle because my life is so different and I have more softness in my life. Whereas like when I was younger, I didn't have that same softness. So I was really tough. And I don't know, I have a lot of respect for my younger self now that I'm older. I can look back and I can be like, you know what? Like you were doing just the best that you could. Yeah.
How did you come up with the word bitch punk?
Oh my gosh, I don't even know. I just remember one day it just came to me. This always happens, like titles for my albums and for my different projects, they just come to me first. They always the title first and then the project comes after. So I remember I had bitch punk in my mind and then I was like, okay, now I have to go and make the songs. Like I always knew it was going to be called bitch punk. Yeah.
And that word reappears on your track Pluto Baby.
Yeah.
On the Good Luck album, where you sound both like seducing and religious. It's probably the hardest track. Pretty brutal.
Yeah.
But what's Pluto got to do with it? Like the most distant planet, where it's not even a planet anymore, right? It was, you know, taken away from the list of planets.
I think they brought it back.
They did?
Yeah, okay, they did. Well, that track in particular, it was like, lyrically, it was an exercise for me, like in rap and just like in, you know, rap style. Like I wouldn't necessarily call myself a rapper, but I enjoy rapping. And whenever I rap, like I want to challenge myself. And I'm really proud of like the lyrics in that one. I think the writing was really strong. And as far as Pluto, like, so I'm into astrology. And in astrology, the planet Pluto signifies deep transformation. It's about like death and rebirth. And it's about, you know, taking something from one form and turning it into another. And so that whole track kind of has this energy of like, it's almost like you're in this void or in this like black hole and there's all this stuff happening and you don't know if you're going to come out on the other end. It's like that intensity of change of like, okay, like something has happened here.
And you use a lot of biblical imagery.
Yeah.
You're saying, I said, I'm sicker than Lazarus, back from the dead. I'm so bitch punk and hazardous.
Yeah.
And then you rap, this is my body, this is my blood, as if you're inviting the listener to a communion or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's did you go to like Catholic church as a child?
Yes, yeah.
They made you.
So like I said, my family's very religious and it's just like, it's part of the culture because in Nigeria, people are very religious. Like I don't know how much you know about Nigeria, but people are very religious. The country is split basically between like half Christian and then half Muslim. And my family, they're Christian. And it's so much a part of like just your everyday life. It's not like growing up, we went to church twice a week, you know? It's like stuff like that. It was so part of my upbringing. Sundays and Fridays. Yeah. And
So Fridays weren't that much of a party day for you.
No. No.
Oh God,
no,
it's Friday.
Like, oh, God. Oh, actually.
2 times a week, that's a lot.
Yeah. And like my parents are both pastors and like religion it was like this overwhelming theme of my upbringing because it's very important to them, like culturally.
So is that a special branch of Catholicism?
well, I guess you could call it, they're like evangelical.
Oh, okay.
Like, so it's under like Christian, you know, the whole umbrella and stuff. But then also my high school, I went to a Catholic high school. I went to a Catholic all girls high school in Montreal, and it was like a private school, and it was up on this huge hill. So you have to walk up this hill and then you come to the school buildings, looks like a castle or something. It was so crazy.
Did you manage to sneak out of that castle
to
go clubbing
as well?
Of course. So how did you do that?
Well, we would,
that must be more difficult than...
We would sneak out to like go at during lunchtime to go smoke weed and, oh my God, okay. I know my parents are going to listen to this, going to be like, what? But like we would do crazy things at that school. Like just, you know, very rebellious. Yeah.
So did you have to go and confess your sins in church as well?
Yeah, we had mass, we had confession and stuff. Yeah, they did. It was the whole thing. They had nuns that lived on the school grounds and stuff. And I had, one of the nuns was one of my teachers. So I kind of had a very like religious, like the religion was around me throughout my whole life, basically. And now I would say like, I'm a very like spiritual person. And it's obvious from that influence. And like, just from growing up, it's like, I know so much literature from the Bible because we'd go to church all the time and you're reading it all the time. So I think like a lot of those references like slip into my writing, like when I'm writing things. But I also think of it as like, you know, so much of the Western world is based upon this book, you know, it's based upon this religion. And for me, like knowing those references kind of makes me feel like I'm able to almost like tap into something that's more subconscious in the collective. Like even if people are not religious, like in their life, like the world around them is really structured through this religion. So, yeah.
Catholicism is a lot about guilt.
Yeah.
You know, installing guilt in people. How did that make you feel as a teenager? You know, when you confessed your sins?
You know what?
Did you even confess them? Because it must have been difficult if, you know...
Not really.
You were in school and you knew that the people listening to your sins might, you know, tell them to other people, I guess?
No, you know what? I never felt guilty. Like, I can't say that I felt guilty because even when I was young, like, I remember being very young and thinking like, like something doesn't make sense. Like, because I would see a lot of people who would say like, they're very religious people, you know, they pride themselves on like, oh, like I'm a good Christian, da, 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 da. But then they would behave in ways that were really awful. And I think that having that like dichotomy there to me just kind of like opened my eyes when I was really young. And I was always like, I questioned everything. Went from the time that I think I was born, I questioned everything. And so I never really felt like guilt. I felt more like, I felt a very like rebellious spirit. Like I wanted to like poke holes in things, you know? Yeah.
In what way did you poke holes into things?
Just always getting in trouble for like a million reasons.
What was the worst?
The worst? Let's see.
Back in school.
Back in school, I would get into trouble a lot for talking during class and not paying attention. But my grades were good. But like, you know, I would not pay attention, all this stuff. I think like I can absorb information really quickly. And so it's just like easy for me. And school wasn't hard. Like I can't say, oh, it was hard. It wasn't hard. I learned, but like it wasn't hard. So I'd get in trouble for talking a lot. I get in trouble for being like bad, you know, like doing things like smoking cigarettes and like, you know, like, or just behaving badly. I guess that's what I'll say. Yeah. So this is Creator by Santi Gold. Got no need for the fancy things, all the attention that it brings. Tell me no, I say yes, I was chosen, and I will deliver the explosion.
How did you discover Santi Gold?
So she is one of the artists I discovered during like the downloading era of music. And I remember just like finding her record. I think before her name used to be Sen Tokold, I believe. And like when I first found that record and I heard like, I think it was Crater, it was Unstoppable, and she had this other song that Jay-Z had remixed or something. But I remember finding that record and my mind was blown. Like, I was like, oh my God, music can sound like this. It's so cool. Like, it's so cool. I thought she was the coolest person in the world. And I listened to that record like back to front like so many times.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
How much do you keep up with Nigerian music? Because that's like a whole world of itself.
Yeah, sort of a little bit. Like, I'm aware of like Afro beats and, you know, the way that Nigerian music has like transformed over the years, because my parents would play Nigerian music when I was younger, like in the house and stuff. And my dad's favorite artist was King Sunny Ade. And I was aware of like Fela Kuti and like all of these really big Nigerian artists who were really popular during the time of like more like jazz, like high life kind of music. But presently, like I love what's happening there. Like, I love that there's like a whole resurgence of like the music scene, and I pay attention. Like, I like Wizkid, I like Omalay. I hear a lot of new music coming out there and I like it.
I found this rapper called Black Sheriff, who was just tremendous, you know, really good. He sounds a bit like Burna Boy and Wizkid. Okay. But it's funny because, you know, back in the days, when people talked about like music from Africa, they used words like world music.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Now it's like, you know, Nigerian music,
yeah,
which differs vastly from other African countries because it's, you know, it's so big.
Yeah.
There's so much stuff.
Yeah. It's the most populated country in Africa.
Have you been back there since you moved to Canada?
No, never. Which is like so crazy. Like, I was born there, but I've never been back.
Do you have any memories from when you were 1 or 2 years old?
More like ambient stuff. So like, I would say this feeling of like heat, because it's right on the equator. So it's a hot country and it only has two weathers, which is either the rainy season or, you know, hot summer. And
you don't get spring or fall.
No, nothing really. It's just, yeah, that's it. And so it's more like ambient stuff, but I don't remember it at all. And I was supposed to go, I think it was in 2020, cause I was going to go see my grandmother, who was like on my mom's side, But then she passed away. And like, I remember we were supposed to go see her because she was really old. She was like in her 90s. She was like 96 or something. And then she ended up passing away. And then the urgency to go there was no longer there because she was like my last grandparent. So now I'm like, well, you know, I'll go when I'm going to go. I'm just going to wait for like the right time.
Have you played live in Africa yet?
No, I haven't, but I really, really want to.
How did you end up on Sub Pop Records? Because your record label is mostly associated with like the Seattle sound of the late 80s. Bands like Soundgarden and Nirvana released their first records on Sub Pop. And they contacted you.
So basically what happened was like when I was working on my album, we were also like shopping the album around to different record labels. So it was me and my manager. And, you know, we were talking to other people and just trying to see like, okay, what's the best move here? Like who to release it with or who's gonna, you know, put out this album. And I was talking to so many people, but then when I had the meeting with Sub Pop, it was just like the best vibe. Like I felt like they understood what I wanted to do as an artist, but more importantly, they were so supportive and they had shown support before because another band that's on their label, like, you know, Clipping. So Clipping had always been supportive online and I knew that they were aware of me.
They have Weissblatt as well, right?
Yes, yeah. And like, so I knew that they were aware of me, but after we had the meeting, like I just felt very confident that they would be my choice, you know?
Your song Runnin' was recently featured in the TV series Goosebumps, which just started on Disney Plus.
Yeah.
Did you watch it as well?
You know, no, I didn't watch it, but I remember right before I came out here on tour, like we have like Disney Plus at home. So I looked up the episode and I watched like the last like 2 minutes and I liked the way they introduced it on the episode. But I've been getting a lot of like comments on YouTube from people who are like, I'm here from Goosebumps.
Yeah. And you made a very long, it's not a video, it's like a short movie for the title track, Good Luck. Which kind of is about how, you know, you go out with your friends, you're getting ready, you're all excited, and you're dressing up and putting on makeup, and then you go to a high school party where you meet some strange man, a hooded figure,
yeah,
or in a wooden mask. How did you come up with that idea?
So that short film is... I always knew that I wanted to make a short film for the album. And when I was writing the album, I was writing the short film at the same time. And like the album is so personal and, you know, it's like about my life and blah, blah, blah. And so it's like I wanted to also translate that into the short film that I was going to make. And so I took so much inspiration from my life. Like all the girls, you know, they go to the all-girls school. I went to the all-girls school, you know, they do the whole party thing. That's what I did. And like, I took all this inspiration. And then the man with the hooded mask, he's kind of like very like symbolic. So that character is like very symbolic of like a lot of things, you know, it's like symbolic of the shadow self, symbolic of like this kind of like nebulous, like masculinity, symbolic of, I don't know, like duality, like all this stuff. Like there's a lot that's like packed into that character. So I wrote it at the same time. And then it took me a really long time to make it, but luckily I was able to film the short film last year, like last summer. And it coincided really nicely with when I was going to release the album. So I'm happy about that.
It starts off with you visiting your old home, and there's a picture of the Virgin Mary on the front door.
Yeah.
Did you have that at home as well?
Oh, we had a lot. We had a lot of Virgin Marys. A lot of crosses, Virgin Mary, whatever. Yeah, we had a lot.
And it seems as if you're in the video, you're kind of falling for a cult leader, but it's not, or a voodoo priest, or it's not.
No, not really. Like,
not specifically, no.
No, like even, so his, the mask itself is from.
Might not even be a man. It could be a woman as
well. Exactly. It's nondescript. It's more, it's like a, there's he's a lot of things, everything. But the mask itself is actually from Sardinia, which is like this little community from Italy. And I remember I was inspired because I had seen this picture online of their like masked festival, and it's called like the Mamatones. I don't know how to pronounce that, but it's this festival that they have every year. And I just loved like the way that they decorated themselves. And I loved the use of the mask as well. And they also had like things like bells on them, and they had these hides and stuff. And so I borrowed a lot from that. And then my co-director he's an Italian, Nathan DePatz Habib. And so he was more familiar like with their traditions and community and stuff. And he actually was the one who helped us source the masks. Like actually, those are actually from Sardinia. Like we had them shipped over to Canada. And yeah, I don't know. Like there's a lot of, it's hard to talk about because I don't know. I always get like this to, when it's talking about like symbolic art, but there's a lot of overlap that I felt with also like African masking traditions. And so I wanted to like blend them and kind of create this hybridity, because so much of what I do is about hybridity. And because I feel like I'm a hybrid person, you know, like I'm Nigerian, Canadian, but I've traveled all over the world and I've seen so many things. I grew up on the internet as well, which adds like another layer. Like it's just all about, you know, really being like a hybrid person and like a mishmash of things. So in the same way, the film is also a mishmash of things.
Speaking of Italian art, you recreate a famous painting by Caravaggio in the video for What a Man, Judith Beheading Holofernes.
Yeah, Artemisia actually, yeah.
The video is basically about you experiencing what people sometimes call the male gaze, I suppose, because you're a model during a croquis session, and then you're a stripper and you're going to an audition for a movie role or something.
Yeah.
Have you done all those things, or is that just in the video?
Just in the video.
Okay, you haven't been a stripper or a croquis model.
No. Okay. Yeah, no, just in the video. But yeah, it is about the male gaze, and it's about this act of looking and, you know, being a woman in the world and being looked at. But even the song itself, like, so the song is like almost like a breakup anthem, because I'm writing about like, oh, basically figuring out that the person that you love is just a man, like, and nothing special and something that didn't work out. And I wanted to make a visual that could kind of like reflect like the emotionality of that, but also connect it to like a context of being a woman. And the main thing was the painting that we recreated and like really tapping into the emotions of that, because we used Artemisia's version. So Artemisia Gentilecci, and she depicted herself as Judith, and she was the man that she was slaying in it. She depicted him as her rapist, because she was raped by this guy when she was, I think, 17. And so she put herself in that pose into her painting. And I thought that was really interesting, because I think that, especially when it comes to like visuals and stuff, like I wanted to make something that women could feel like, oh, I can put myself as well into this. And even me as an artist, it's like I put myself into these, and it's because we have this shared experience as women in the world.
You saying, I closed my eyes, saw what he was. I saw the beast. I held his hand. Who were you dating when you...
A terrible guy.
And has that beastly man heard the song?
Yes. But I'm sure he's heard it. I don't know what he thinks about it, but, you know.
You're not in touch anymore.
No, let's just say that.
Why do we fall for people who are bad for us?
Because we have problems. I don't know. I honestly don't know.
I mean, biology should make us, you know, attracted to people who treat us well.
You would think so, but maybe... maybe it's that like we fall for people that are bad for us to build character, is the way that I see it, you know, because you wouldn't know what you were made of if you didn't go through like really tough situations.
Some people, I guess, can be a bit like drugs, you know, they're fun at first and you feel great, and then it's just a disaster.
I know.
And you feel
it ruins
terrible.
Your life. Yeah. This is You Know I'm No Good by Amy Winehouse.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Like I knew. What has Amy Winehouse meant to you?
Oh my goodness. I think she was the first artist that I truly became obsessed with. Like, I was obsessed with her, and I had this like really deep emotional connection to her music. Like, she's an amazing writer, amazing singer, and she came to me at a time, I don't know, like I don't remember how old I was even, but like I was really young. I hadn't experienced any of the stuff that she was singing about, but she has this emotionality when she is singing. And I discovered her also during like YouTube, like when YouTube was first becoming a thing. So I would watch hours and hours of her live performances of all of her songs. And I had like books on her. I had posters. I had her CDs. I had like, I was obsessed with her. And I even remember where I was the day that she passed away. Like, I remember I was on my phone. It was like a BlackBerry at the time. And I was on, people were like posting in their like BBM, you could put like a status, and they're like, RIP Amy Winehouse, RIP Amy Winehouse. And I was like, what are you talking about? And then I went on my computer on Facebook and I saw that people were posting about that she had passed away. And then I looked it up, and this TMZ article came up. It's like, Amy Winehouse like passed away, and I remember I dropped to my knees, and I started crying so profusely. I was heartbroken.
How much did her like decadent lifestyle affect yours? Because sometimes when you worship people who, you know, live dangerously, you kind of want to experience the same thing.
Mm, I'd see it more as like almost like a parallel. It's not so much about like, oh, her lifestyle made me want to do that. But I think it's like there's a reason I connected with her, because whatever trouble she was going through is also something that I was feeling, you know? So there's like this connection of emotion and trauma or whatever, you know, hardship.
Are there any people that you dream of collaborating with?
So many. Yeah, so many. Like, of course, there's people who I guess you could say are like in my genres that I'd love to collaborate with, like people I look up to and was inspired by. We were talking earlier just about some of the music festivals out here, like people like Sevdaliza or Death Grips or Rosalia, Sega Bodega, like Arca, you know, just all these artists that I really, it influenced me like from my DJ days and into my days when I started producing music. But then there's also people I'd love to collaborate with who've just, I don't know, people that I like in general, you know? This is It Cold in the Water by Sophie.
Scottish artist who died tragically, falling from a roof, right? Or from a balcony?
Yeah, from a balcony. I know. That broke my heart as well, too. Like, I think that Sophie is, like, one of those once-in-a-lifetime kind of talents. Like, she really changed music and electronic music in a way that just cannot be replicated. Like, her influence is undeniable. And I think that she represented like so much of what made hyperpop even become like something that could connect with people, because she never shied away from like making, yes, it was like bright and shiny, but it was also, there was like an emotional undercurrent to all of it. Like her music, like it was beautiful. It was like, you know, you could feel something. It almost felt like classical in this way. Like I always describe her music as having like a certain classical element to it, actually.
And now she's gone, like Amy Winehouse. So two of your heroes you won't be able to collaborate with, probably. Unless some AI program revives them.
No, never.
You won't mess with that.
No, I would never, no.
How do you feel about the new Beatles track? Have you heard it?
No, I haven't heard it.
They've kind of restored John Lennon's vocals using AI. It's not like as if the program is singing, but it's interpreting how the vocals would sound if the quality was crystal clear. So it's... Really, you know, when you listen to it, you kind of imagine how, you know, what will happen in a few years when they start reviving everyone.
I've said this before to people. I'm like, I want to put a clause in my will that says, like, you're not allowed to use AI on me. Don't bring me back as a hologram. Don't do any of that. Like, no.
Still, I do love Johnny Cash's version of Aqua's Barbie Girl.
Oh, you know what? I haven't heard it. They did another AI thing.
That technology was meant for.
Wow.
How long is this tour?
So this tour is about 2.5 weeks. We've been at it for, about like a week and a half now. We started off in Manchester and now we're here. Where were we yesterday? Yesterday we were in Copenhagen. And then we do Stockholm today. And then tomorrow we go to London.
And what's the response been like?
It's been really good because I was here back in May of this year. Like I was in Europe and that was like the first like European leg of the Good Luck Tour. And this time feels like different. Like that other time was the first time that I had been back since 2019. Like I hadn't been in Europe since 2019. And, you know, people came out to the shows and stuff and the response was good, but this time it feels different. Like this time at each show, there's been like dedicated fans, like people who know every single word from the record and they know all the old songs, they know the discography and they're there, they're at the front and they're like, you know, they're really participating and very enthusiastic and giving me this energy, just like it's so beautiful to see. It makes me really like, it touches my heart a lot.
What was your very first performance like?
So my first performance was in Montreal, actually. I played this festival called Slut Island. And
that's a great name. Slut Island. Okay.
Yeah.
Did you invite your parents?
Oh, no,
I'm playing Slut Island on Friday. No, you gotta go to church.
Slut Island on Friday, church on Sunday. No. but that was my first like live performance and it was like amazing. I think I had the best like first live experience because there was like all of my friends and like this whole community of people that I had known for a long time. And it was the perfect venue. It was at Bar Le Ritz, I remember, which is like this staple venue in Montreal where all of the like... a lot of like the queer parties used to happen there, but also like good, interesting, like electronic stuff would always happen there. And yeah, like it was at Bar Le Ritz and I played and I think I only played for like 15 minutes because I only had like four songs, but it was so much fun. It was great. Yeah.
And you haven't experienced any disasters on stage, right?
Well, not every show is going to be.
Haven't hurt yourself? You don't stage dive, do you?
No. No, I've never hurt myself and, you know, some shows are better than others. Like just depends on the mood you're in, the mood the audience is in, like what's going on. But no, I haven't had any like disasters at all yet. And I hope I don't. Is this wood? Yeah, I'll knock on that.
Well, good luck with that.
Okay, well, I'm going to go. I've got to get ready for the show tonight.
Well, it's been a true pleasure having you here, Debbie Friday.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. This is great.
Good luck.
Thank you. See you. Bye. I ride the waves, but I'm sitting up, I'm counting sheep. I try to run, but I love you, no, I'm in too deep. You are my son, my beloved, you're my baby. I kiss your lips, kiss your face, oh boy, you taste so sweet. It's by my side, but between us is the light and heat.
Den här podcasten producerades av Daniel Bäckström för Lejon Media. Debbie Friday var hemma hos Dragan.